Hey guys, before we delve into this episode, I wanted to let you know that my guest, Dan Sherrill, and I talk a lot about the Build Back Better bill, the $3.5 trillion reconciliation bill the Democrats are trying to pass. It was designed to include an ambitious clean energy program to help the U.S. transition away from fossil fuels. Since we recorded this interview, Senator Joe Manchin has essentially torpedoed this legislation. There's now talk of replacing it with a carbon tax bill of some sort. It's not a done deal yet, but it's all hanging in the balance as I speak. The Sunrise Movement, with whom Dan Sherrill has collaborated, have put out a call to action. I encourage you to participate however you can. Go to sunrisemovement.org. Thank you. Welcome back to In the Weeds. We're beginning our new season on the climate crisis with a conversation I had with Daniel Sherrill about his recent book, Warmth, Coming of Age at the End of Our World. Dan Sherrill is a climate organizer. He's been tackling the climate crisis since he was in college at Brown University, where he and a group of students lobbied the university to divest from the fossil fuel industry. He later worked with NYRE News. He was instrumental in getting New York State to pass what remains the most ambitious climate legislation in the country. These days, he's the campaign director for the Climate Jobs National Resource Center in Washington, D.C. Sherrill wrote Warmth during a break from his career as an organizer. Thanks to a Fulbright and artist-in-residence grants, he was able to take a step back and reflect on his career and on the emotional fallout of growing up in the age of climate change. The book takes the shape of a letter to his imagined future child and reckons with the full breadth of his frustration, his grief, rage, despair, and hope. It's a reckoning with his personal journey, but also with that of his generation, millennials. I'm going to read you a little passage to give you an idea. All right, here we go. A few months before coming to the retreat, I'd had an appointment with my therapist the day before my 26th birthday. I remember telling him, with a vehemence that surprised us both, that I hated 1990, the year of my birth, how my generational cohort had had the bad luck of being born right when the problem was first emerging into public consciousness, how we'd had to watch over the next three decades as it transformed from McGibbon's urgent threat to Colbert's looming inevitability, how this whole process had tracked our coming of age. Better to have been born in ignorance a century earlier, I told him, or even a century hence, when things might really start to deteriorate. Anything but this awful century of waiting, of bracing. I have to say, I really related to this passage. I'm not a millennial, I'm Gen X, you know, the slacker generation. But I do think it speaks to the uncanny way in which the climate crisis maps itself onto our experiences as individuals. For me, personally, it sometimes feels like the climate crisis has dovetailed with my midlife crisis. The loss of people and places from my childhood deepened by the sense of loss on a much larger scale. We're going to be talking about how culture shapes nature in the form of climate change this season, which, let's face it, is kind of redundant. Climate change is the very definition of culture shaping our relationship to the natural world. But before we take up the guise of cultural critics again, I wanted to start the season by talking about what it feels like to reckon with the climate crisis. I found Dan's book to be a great way to get into this. He's raw at times, but also whip smart and analytical, and he turns out to be pretty fun to talk to as well. One little footnote before we begin, a word you'll be hearing a lot this season is Anthropocene. In case you're not familiar with it, it's a geological term, analogous to, say, the Paleozoic. It designates the era in which human activity has had a significant impact on the Earth's climate and ecosystems. It hasn't been officially adopted by the major institutions of geology yet, nor is there consensus about exactly when the Anthropocene begins. But it's widely used as a kind of shorthand for the irrevocable impact of human culture on Earth's climate and life. Speaking of terms, Dan avoids them. In Warmth, he never refers to the climate crisis or climate change by name. Instead, he calls it the problem with a capital P. I asked him why.
The phrase climate change, when it was evoked, it felt like it had a really strong discursive pull into a pretty narrow little pigeonhole that was relatively technocratic, scientific, bureaucratic, and just sort of overwhelming and horrible, but also strangely dry and dead. And I think for a lot of people I talk to, you would say the words climate change, and the conversation would immediately be shunted into a very specific direction that didn't have a lot of running room, I felt like. And this was true even for me, I think. Those words often felt inadequate coming out of my mouth to describe what was actually happening. So I chose to try to break the climate crisis out of that narrow discursive box in order to try my best to have a real encounter with it, not as a thing that was arriving to me sort of mute and fully baked from these doomsday headlines, but as a thing that was actively transpiring in small and big ways in my life and all the lives of the people that I love. And I think also, you know, in some ways, you could easily substitute the words climate change for the problem in my book, and it would still make intelligible sense. But the deeper I got into writing the book, I think the more I realized that the climate crisis itself, i.e. the accumulation of carbon molecules in the atmosphere causing a rise in average global surface temperatures, that was sort of more of a symptom than a problem. And the problem ran deeper than that, deep, I think, into the human and civilizational psyche. I think I wanted to be able to think more broadly about what was happening and to encounter it without the normal sort of filters that come attached to it.
I feel like one of the things, I feel like as a narrative device, it's effective because it heightens our awareness, right? Mm-hmm. But I feel like it also personalizes it, which is funny because, you know, problem with a capital P would seem to be very general in a way. But in spite of that, it makes it a more personal undertaking.
Yeah. I mean, I talk about that problem as a hyperobject, which is a philosophical term that the metaphysician Timothy Morton coined in the early 2000s.
Hyperobjects, as defined by the philosopher Timothy Morton, are objects that are so huge in space and in time that they defy our notion of what an object is. Things that we can name, like climate change, but that are too unwieldy for us to wrap our heads around.
The climate crisis as a problem, it's not a singular problem. It's a thing with, you know, millions of facets. Mm-hmm. And a facet that shows up in each of our individual lives slightly differently. And so, yeah, I guess it needed to be mutable in that way for people to feel like this is a thing that shows up in a very specific way in their life and is not a monolith that they can't access except through, you know, headlines in the New York Times.
Right, right. In the book, you reject this false dichotomy, which is that we have the choice either to respond emotionally, to sort of mourn, or to act, to engage. So you write, I'm going to quote you here, "I no longer believe that grief and resistance are mutually exclusive. I think the former is necessary to the latter, that honest sorrow is perhaps the only thing that makes a real fight possible." I was wondering if you could talk about that a bit, about why you think we need to open ourselves up to our feelings in order to resist, in order to fight back.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, I'll say that opening ourselves up to our feelings about climate change, I don't only have a utilitarian take around that. I think it is. I think it's a good in and of itself. And for me, it has felt like that asymptotic attempt has made me feel more fully human and more fully alive in the 21st century, even if that feeling of being alive in the 21st century can be painful. And mournful sometimes. But I guess I just had this intuition that if I kept the magnitude of the climate crisis locked up in the Pandora's box that society provides us with to compartmentalize it, it would eventually break out of its own accord and just trample me, you know?
Yeah.
And so in a way, it was a feeling like I have to develop my own relationship to this thing that is going to be shaping all of every human life on the planet Earth for the next several centuries. I need to develop a relationship to that thing or else I won't be ready to live through it. And I don't know, like most unspoken points of emotional anguish, I think processing can create not a sense of ease, but at least a sense of understanding.
Yeah.
And a sense of meaning. So I think that's important in and of itself. But I also, for me, people might not know it, but I'm, you know, my day job is as a brass tacks political organizer, trying to realign dynamics of power in state capitals and in Washington so that we can essentially out-organize the fossil fuel industry, which is doing its best to send our civilization off a cliff. And I think if I didn't have an actual emotional relationship to the climate crisis, and if that work wasn't grounded for me in the love of the things that I'm trying to protect and preserve, and the love of a utopic society that I can envision on the horizon, where resources and the planet are treated with dignity and respect, and workers and labor are treated with dignity and respect, the lack of which has been a huge source of the climate crisis, I'd argue. My love for that vision and those very real, tangible people and places, if that wasn't at the core of my organizing, then I think very soon politics would just become a game. And I see this for a lot of people that only hang out in the political world, that it's sort of like, you know, that book Ender's Game?
Mm-hmm.
Where the whole premise is, I read this a long time ago, but I think this is true. They recruit a whole bunch of like young genius prodigies to like play this video game that's supposed to be training them to do battle with this alien civilization. And they're training on this program. And then the big reveal at the end was, in fact, they really were fighting the aliens via a computer program the whole time. Like, it was real life warfare that they were orchestrating. And I feel like it can feel similarly with the climate crisis, that if you retract too far into politics, it's just like a game you're playing. You're not in touch with the very real human stakes that lie behind the switchboard. Mm-hmm. And I think that makes you less strategic. It makes you less persuasive. And it also makes you more liable to burnout, I think. But likewise, on the other side of the spectrum, if you sink entirely into grief, into emotional processing, I mean, I feel like, you know, I see an increasing number of spaces that are meant as support spaces, but are essentially saddled with a feeling of fatalistic despair around the climate crisis. And A, I don't think that fatalistic despair is warranted, and we can talk more about that. But B, it's relinquishing kind of a responsibility to people and saying that, you know, relinquishing your agency you have to mitigate harm to those things. And in some ways, relinquishing your place in the flow of history, where decisions about who lives and who dies get made. So I feel like walking that tightrope. Antonio Gramsci, the great Italian Marxist philosopher, has a great quote, something along the lines of, the challenge of life in modernity is to live without illusion, without becoming disillusioned. And that's the tightrope I'm always trying to walk.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like a big part of the challenge starts with the challenge of understanding what's happening in the world to begin with, not just intellectually, but in a way that has real significance to our lives, right? Or that, as you said, it's the problem is more than just the warming of the planet itself, but it has these tentacles everywhere. But also, it's happening on such a scale, both temporally and physically, that it's hard for our little human brains and to catch up with it, right? So our emotions are bound to be struggling as well to make sense of it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'll probably spend the rest of my life trying to wrap my heart around this enormous, undigestible hyperobject we're calling the climate crisis. I don't, you know, I'm not sure there'll ever be an endpoint in that process. But at the same time, I think you really do have to make a choice, I think, to try to access those feelings and to take the crisis out of whatever compartment you've put it into. And I know many people who I love and who have great politics and who lead blameless, often admirable lives, who haven't chosen to take that step because it seems too hard. And I guess for me, at least, I think the harder thing would be to live my life through a series of worsening disasters without taking that step, while trying to maintain a sort of an increasingly brittle blinder around what's actually happening.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I see real courage in what you're doing as well, I have to say.
So before we delve into the emotions a little bit more, I wanted to talk about the fact that the book is written as a letter to your maybe future child. Can you talk about that a little bit? You say that it started as notes that you jotted down on your phone. What made you decide to go ahead with that and to make that the shape of this book?
I mean, it was never a very deliberate choice, to be honest. And I've honestly thought that if I were to go back and write the book again, I might choose a different interlocutor. Not that I regret it, but that I think like one of the chief ethical responsibilities of life in the Anthropocene is to stretch the margins of your attention as wide as they can possibly go to as many people and things as they can possibly accommodate. And so in a way, using the very tried and true method of writing to my own hypothetical future child, it was sort of an easy route. And at the same time, I want to be generous with myself and with many people who've chosen that route before me, which is that, you know, of course we're going to experience this massive systemic problem through the people we love most, even if they're hypothetical. And I think for me, writing to this person was A, an opportunity to be vulnerable. For some reason, imagining a small child who is part of my family opened up a space of vulnerability that I had a hard time accessing otherwise. And I also just think, I mean, it was very practical as well. I sensed myself deliberating and feeling very ambivalent about the prospect of being a father, even though I knew a part of me was really excited about that prospect and thought that that was a beautiful thing to do with one's life. But the book in some ways was a test. Like, could I address this hypothetical person in a tone that didn't cave to blind optimism or deflate into fatalistic despair? But could I write to them honestly in the middle of those two things, but still hold them in a place of like tenderness, I guess? And if I couldn't do that, then there was no way I could justify having a family. So it was literally like kind of like a preparatory step in a very tangible way. I felt like I needed to be able to hand them a document that would start this conversation. I'm not saying that was like, that's the only condition to having a child, but that felt like a necessary one, if not a sufficient one.
It might be interesting to revisit if you end up having children, right?
Yeah, my partner has asked me, you know, if you have a child or if we have children together, like, when are you going to give this to them? I was like, oh God, that's a good question. I was like, well, on their bar mitzvah, obviously.
Given that it starts out with a suicide.
I know. It's really intense. It's really intense. And that's a question that, you know, the actual parents out there, I'm sure, have much better insight on than I do.
Yeah. So I have two kids. I have an 11-year-old and a 13-year-old. And I would say vulnerability is the word that popped out of what you said for me, is that certainly talking about the problem in light of children or to my children really strikes that chord of vulnerability, because of course that's where you are most vulnerable.
Yep.
But at the same time, you know, it occurs to me that when you're talking about it in relation to your kids, despair really isn't an option, you know? I mean, you can give up if all that's at stake is your life, but once your kids are involved, that's no longer an option.
Yeah, despair is like abandonment in that case.
I mean, that's one of the things that's sort of both exhausting but also very edifying about having children, is that, you know, no matter how you screw up on a given day, the next day you just have to pick everything up and get back to work, right?
Yeah, my God.
It honestly
it seems beautiful and daunting, the prospect of having children with or without the climate crisis, honestly. But I can't quite picture the moment where I would actually hand this to them, but I think I really would. I hope that would be the start of an important conversation between us and an important form of solidarity, you know, to think and emote as rigorously as I can about this thing that is going to affect their life even more than it has mine, I see as a form of standing with them, or trying my best to.
Well, I think, you know, whether it's to your future child or just in general to other human beings, I think the fact that your book is an address, that it's made personal that way is important. You know, it makes me think, I had a therapist once whose sort of parting words to me were, go towards the emotions, but not alone. And it's one of those things that I've just carried with me ever since then, and because it seems to have sort of profound implications. And I think that's one of the tenets maybe that works its way through your book as well, is the need to connect as we work our way through what is a kind of unending, difficult situation.
Yeah. Yeah, that's so apt. And that's kind of what I was trying to do with the book. I mean, in some ways, like, I think subconsciously I wrote this book in order to create the kind of conversational community I felt the lack of in my early days of climate activism, in that it felt lonely to carry this weight. Even among my fellow activists, it felt lonely because we didn't have the words or the cultural avenues to hold that weight. And so we sort of just compartmentalized it. And it felt like it would often feel too much to bear for one person. But then I wouldn't know where to turn. Like, who do I talk to this about? You know,
That's interesting, yeah. Because at times reading you, I felt slightly envious of your activist community. I mean, I guess I have a little bit of that. My way of engaging is that I serve on the local government in the village where I am. And so I'm involved in initiatives that way. But in society as a whole, you know, if you're walking around carrying the weight of climate change, you can start to feel a bit mad,
totally. You know,
a bit crazy.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah.
And so when you talk about feeling lonely, I definitely relate to that emotion in that way of just, it can be very isolating.
Yeah, exactly. And the book has kind of given an excuse to a lot of people I love, and also to people I don't know, to like have this hard conversation about like what have we gotten ourselves into and where do we go from here? Just in terms of like, you know, living a meaningful life still in the 21st century. So I've been so grateful for that. And it's like sort of exceeded my expectations. But yeah, I totally hear you on the feeling of, on the crazy feeling. I mean, the way I describe it in the book is like, you know, being a climate activist, being like in a nightmare where you see a monster bearing down on everybody and you try to scream, but nobody can hear you. It felt like that for a while. It feels less like that now, obviously, as the climate crisis burns its way further and further into the center of our political discourse. But this book was also, as it was trying to break through that wall that people erect or that our society has erected, it's also trying to then not have people collapse under the weight as that wall crumbles, you know, not immediately tip into, oh my God, we're fucked. And holding people and holding myself in that middle ground seems like is both incredibly challenging and I think like the only way I see forward.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So going into some of the emotions you explore, one is anger. So you have a chapter called Outrage, and you talk specifically about Scott Pruitt, who was, of course, named administrator of the EPA by Donald Trump in 2017, with the task basically of dismantling big parts of the EPA and deregulating industry and so on. Let me just read a passage from your book, which stood out to me. So you write, "This was a time when great evils could be and often were hidden in the dullest corners of things, the shifting margins of the tax code, the ephemera at the bottom of ingredients list, the slight changes in the value of certain types of esoteric derivatives. Over dinner at parties, it was therefore difficult and unpopular to talk about what was going on, which was that Scott Pruitt and his cohort were in the midst of perpetuating what could reasonably be considered a genocide, perhaps the largest of all time." You go on, "I think it had something to do," so you're talking about why it's so difficult to name this, "I think it had something to do with how much of our ethics were still built on the foundation of intent, reliant on the increasingly irrelevant language of person-to-person causality, murder, theft, adultery. These were problems for which we had a script." So how do we deal with, or how do we address the fact that we don't have an ethics that really speaks to the wrongs that are being done?
Yeah. I think, so the liberal, capital L liberal fantasy of how we solve the problem of Scott Pruitt, and this is the fantasy inherent in, for example, Al Gore's An Inconvenient Truth, is that we craft a persuasive enough argument and have it come out of persuasive enough mouths. And we work and work and work at that. And eventually Scott Pruitt will see the error of his ways, or like more level-headed individuals will win out and the day will be saved. And I think that is utterly wrong. And it is wrong in the way that it is seduced by the facade of the individual. It still sees, even in the 21st century, it still sees individual people as the prime ethical actors. And I think that's just not the case anymore. We live in a society where the web of humanity is so densely interwoven, and massive institutional forces over which we have no control shape such fundamental parts of our lives, down to like what we pay attention to. Those decisions are increasingly being made for us by very persuasive multinational social media companies. I think in that state of affairs, the individual is no longer the primary ethical actor. We have to think in systems and we have to think in institutions. And so seeing Scott Pruitt as a good or bad individual who can be convinced or might fail to be convinced is totally, I think, the wrong aperture to look at the problem. The problem is more about what is the massive institutional iceberg of which Scott Pruitt is the tip, and how do we move that iceberg? So in a way, like, we kind of have to see through Scott Pruitt, like not get distracted by him, the individual, and not get distracted by our rage, which still, I think, gloms on to individuals because that's how humans are programmed. Because there's not going to be any convincing Scott Pruitt. And even if we did, even if he did a mea culpa, you know, the snake would just grow a new head. It wouldn't mean anything. So we have to not be distracted by him as an individual, and have to be incredibly rigorous about how do we build enough political power to discipline the institution that he represents, the fossil fuel industry, and regulate them into the ground, essentially. And so it's sort of like not having our ethics. It's hard, right? Because you kind of have to decouple your ethics from your innate emotional response, which still is. And I think it would be hard. I don't want to say impossible at all, actually, but still intuitively people react to individuals on an emotional level. And I think we have to decouple that a little bit and be able to realize that the path to salvation here runs not through some rational debate among individual actors, but through a massive sea change of how power is distributed across institutions. So that's like the change that I'm sort of proposing. How we get from one to the other. I mean, I see it happening already. Even when I have conversations, you know, with folks in my parents' generation, and I try to communicate to them that, like, for example, from my vantage, somebody like Josh Gottheimer, a clean-cut, nice Jewish boy, I can say that as a fellow nice Jewish boy from northern New Jersey who ran, you know, Clinton acolyte, who ran on a solidly moderate Blue Dog platform, blah, 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 that he is committing genocidal acts. And I don't even want to say he is committing them. Like, Josh Gottheimer is just a pawn, I think, or like a cog in a larger institution called neoliberalism. Sorry, for context, he's like a member of the House who's currently trying to whittle down and or scuttle the $3.5 trillion reconciliation package that's currently on a knife's edge in Congress and represents the most ambitious climate legislation this country has ever considered by several orders of magnitude. He's essentially trying to destroy that at the behest of various corporate donors and an ideology that states that Democrats should just aspire to be Republicans light, Republicans that, whatever, have gay cousins or something. But I think my parents look at somebody like Josh Gottheimer, who I'm sure is lovely interpersonally, and they can't quite see past that. And I think my generation, especially Gen Z, try to be at least much more rigorously clear-eyed about seeing through the individuals who are to some extent beside the point to the institutional bedrock on which they're built, and then be able to call out exactly what's happening on the level of that bedrock.
So the iceberg. So I might as well ask you, so how do we move the iceberg?
That's not a
loaded metaphor at all.
Yeah, totally. It's a huge undertaking, but I think the pithiest way of articulating that it is that we have to build a movement that can coordinate action among a large enough and influential enough swath of the population so that we can set litmus tests for our elected leaders about how ambitious they are on the climate crisis and have those litmus tests met, wield our power as a way to adjudicate who is representing us in government and who's making the decisions about how we do or do not tackle the climate crisis. And then I also think that movement has to be able to campaign around policy as well. And that means in some ways shifting the public narrative and shifting the Overton window to change what is possible politically and what is considered common sense. And I think you've already seen that happen to a huge degree, even the last 5 years around climate change. I mean, you know, before Bernie Sanders' second run for president, the Green New Deal was just, you know, that was a term that was thrown around in like the narrowest activist circles I was hanging out with in New York, didn't really have any steam. The dominant discourse around climate policy was like, you know, we would levy a minor carbon tax and that the markets would fix everything. And now what we're talking about is public investment in a new economy to the tune of trillions of dollars. That would have been completely politically impossible even 5 years ago. And we're on the cusp of making it happen now, although it's far from assured. And I think that is thanks in large part to social movements, people like the Sunrise Movement who have like yanked the climate crisis into the center of the political discourse, people like the Justice Democrats and the folks that they elect who try to exact a political price for being a dinosaur on the climate crisis, and then the actual crisis itself, which is to a greater and greater degree infiltrating into people's lived experience, sometimes in disastrous ways. And so we need that to happen in the US, and then we need, at least in the democracies around the world, we need similar movements to shift their governments. And then we need less democratic countries, or one might even argue anti-democratic countries like China, to feel like they will be left behind technologically and geopolitically if they don't get out in front of the decisions that movements have compelled democracies to make for themselves. And then countries like Russia, I don't fucking know what we do with Russia. You know, that's a hard thing. But you know, I can very much see a world in which like wildfires are ravaging the entire American Midwest every year, that we're placing crippling embargoes on Russian goods if they continue to invest in new fossil fuel projects, for example, because it's just such an obvious security threat to our citizens. And I don't think that's hard to imagine in our lifetimes at all. So that's like the rough sketch. You know, do I have the month by month plan? I wish I did, but we make the road by walking, as Machado once said.
Well, that'll do for now, for sure.
Yeah.
So I want to go back to this shift from the individual to the institution. What does that mean on an individual level? I mean, as individuals, because I feel like one of the things that I struggle with, and I think a lot of people struggle with, and I think sometimes is a real obstacle to action, is this sense that, you know, I drive a car, even if it is an electric car, but I mean, if I put gas in the car, if I'm, you know, buying groceries that are wrapped in plastic, all these things that, you know, are just part of our daily lives make us feel implicated in the problem. So I don't know if this relates directly to what you were saying.
No,
but
it totally does. It totally does.
Okay. Oh,
yeah.
Good.
I think I, without offering people cop out, because that's not what I'm doing, I really try to encourage people, especially in generations above me, to put that whole mental framework aside. It is not politically useful. And I think to imagine that in 2021, when we have 2 decades to decarbonize the global economy, that our path to salvation on climate would run through the accumulation of individual decisions to recycle, for example, I think is completely bonkers. Like, that path is foreclosed to us and it was maybe never open. But we were taught very early on in the 80s and 90s when the capital E environmental movement was mostly white and mostly shoehorned itself nicely into late capitalism, that our primary locus of political activity was as individual consumers, and that's where we could leverage our power. And so it trapped an entire generation of environmentalists in this guilt loop, wringing their hands, deciding whether they should spring for the CFL light bulb or not versus the regular one, and feeling horrible about themselves because sometimes they couldn't do that. You know, they couldn't bring themselves to purify their consumption choices. And that's because the game was rigged all along. Like, perfectly ethical consumption is not possible in the system as we've built it. It's just simply not possible. And so do we waste our emotional and political energy trying to perfect the imperfectible and achieve a sort of moral hygiene? Or do we use our emotional and political energy accepting the fact that we live inside of a compromised system and cannot get out of it? So instead, try to join up with others to build political power, to change the system, and obviate those impossible consumption choices. Because basically what I'm saying is, like, the fossil fuel industry loves it when people take the climate crisis onto their individual shoulders as consumers. Because A, they know it's a fucking losing game. Excuse my language. People are going to get mired in guilt and I would argue, erroneous feelings of hypocrisy and be politically neutered. And they'll be able to continue with their juggernaut unthreatened by all these environmentalists who they've essentially trapped in this guilt spiral. So without casting all of that aside, like, I think it is inherently good to align your consumption choices with your values to the best of your ability and to the best of your capacity. I feel like I see many more people kind of stuck in that loop and not really being proactive or rigorous about the systemic level than vice versa. And I think that ratio needs to be radically flipped. So I'm not telling people, like, go drive a gas guzzler and eat hamburgers. Like, you shouldn't. Those are bad decisions in the 21st century. But the worst decision, I would argue, is to not be part of the movement that is trying to build enough political power to contest, to wrench the helm of our democracy away from the wealthiest industry on the planet.
That's a really powerful message. I really appreciate your saying that.
Yeah.
All right. So I want to get to grief. Loss, actually, is the title of your chapter. I was impressed and at times overwhelmed by how you explore every nook and cranny of your grief. Mm-hmm. There was something cathartic and also intimidating at moments about it.
Yeah.
Well, the funny thing is, one of the things you start with is your difficulty sometimes in actually accessing your feelings about the problem. The numbness, I feel like, is in some ways one of the most troubling things that you explore.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't even say some of the time. I would say most of the time, I am not in touch with emotions that seem commensurate to the magnitude of the problem. Most of the time, I'm seduced by the ordinary, you know? I just live my days like anybody else, and the present is a very compelling place, and you attend to it as a matter of course. And the present doesn't always contain the climate crisis in an obvious way, although it's always lurking there as a subtext. I don't know. I want to be sympathetic to that. You know, I think if we, to walk around eternally with the full weight of the crisis slung around your neck, I think would probably be impossible.
And probably not very helpful either.
And probably not very helpful. But to never allow yourself to open up for it, I think, is almost the deeper risk, the deeper psychological risk and the deeper planetary risk. You know, and the numbness comes, I think, with our emotional response to human anguish kind of short-circuiting once it goes beyond the people we immediately know or goes beyond a number of people that we could possibly know. You know, the famous thing is, like, you know, if you send a fundraising appeal to people saying that 500,000 people are going to die isn't effective, but showing the face of one child who might die due to famine will bring in the dollars. I think that's a real dynamic.
That seems like how we're wired as human beings, right? I'm not sure that's necessarily a failing.
No, totally. I don't think it is a failing. Although I think the term wired is a bit, I don't know, I can find it a bit facile sometimes, because I think we're wired in all sorts of ways that we've created a civilization in order to transcend, you know?
True enough.
And I think this is one of those points where we have to rise above ourselves. And I think the incredible malleability and plasticity of human consciousness is, like, one of our great gifts. I think we can shape ourselves and, by consequence, the world in our own image to a shocking degree, certainly compared with other species. So with great power comes great responsibility in that way. But I guess I just want to say that I think being complacent about the numbness is no longer an option in the 21st century. I think feeling numb to the full weight of the climate crisis sometimes is unavoidable and, I think, very human. And so I try to be, like, gentle and patient with myself around that, even as I try other times to push myself towards the edge of the cliff and look over.
And feel empathy, too. I think that's an important thread in your book as well.
Yeah.
That it's not just about feeling grief for oneself or feeling grief for the natural world kind of writ large, but tapping into empathy, not only for those you know, but for those you don't know.
Yeah. I think you can tell who I voted for in the primary, but that phrase of Bernie Sanders, where, you know, the campaign slogan to fight for somebody you've never met before, I think that is an impossible goal, and yet that needs to be the North Star and the horizon of our politics in this century if we're going to live up to the values we claim to hold around, like, every life being inherently and equally valuable.
I'd like to, I mean, speaking of empathy or other lives, I'd like to talk a little bit about the natural world too. One of the parts of your book that I really enjoyed was where you talk about the words that are used to frame the issues that we're talking about and how often they fail. So at one point you say that you don't consider yourself an environmentalist because that word is so problematic. So here I'll quote a little bit. You write, "By the time I was old enough to use it, the word," you're talking about environmentalism, "seemed to invoke a species of paternalistic love, a de facto separation. The environment was a whale in danger, a beautiful but distant forest. Everyone wanted to protect the environment, but few engage with it regularly." Is that a problem you've thought about a lot? The way that the words that we use kind of stand in the way of being able to think about the natural world or connect in some way?
Yeah, I mean, I think in particular that word environment, or like words like wilderness or et cetera, I think we've created a whole lexicon in the West of linguistic technologies we use to cleave the human from the non. And I think just ontologically, that was always a mistake. And practically, that was always a mistake. I mean, I think the reason, you know, for example, in Australia, where I write about a bit, you have Aboriginal societies that have survived in a continuous cultural lineage for tens of thousands of years, something that is hard for us to imagine as a part of quote unquote Western civilization, is because they never affected that cleavage. And I think that cleavage it's wrought with a lot of things, but words are a part of that. And yeah, you know, it's interesting. I mean, in many ways with this book, I was like trying to use language to get beyond it. Like I was trying to write my way to a place beyond the words I was using, into a sort of unspeakable emotional state. And I guess that's true for the natural world as well. When I think about dissolving the ontological barriers I've been taught to place between my monkey body and the ecosystems that feed and hydrate me, for me, just as an individual, that often runs through language, but I'm trying to get to an emotional state that sort of is underneath or beyond language. And that can be a challenge, but I'm not sure I always know a better path.
I hear what you're saying. I mean, the funny thing to me is those words that we associate with the cleavage of the human and the non-human, a lot of them in their origins or, you know, in their earlier uses actually kind of conflated the two, right?
Yeah.
Really speak to the conflation of the human and the non-human. But yes, but then they become wielded as this like civilization versus nature kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So you talked about the Aboriginal, and I love the passage in your book where you talk about taking that walk. So you wrote the book partly in Australia, is that right?
Yeah, I wrote most of the book in Australia on a fellowship where I was just had the unbelievable gift of being able to write every day and not go broke.
Nice. Did that experience of being invited into the Aboriginal communities and going on that long walk with them, did that shift your perspective at all? Did it change the tenor of your writing at all?
Yeah, it did. I don't know about the tenor of my writing, but the tenor of my thought about the natural world. I mean, I think I kind of came in with a white person's conception of the environment, quote unquote, being sacrosanct to Indigenous people. And in a way that's true, but in not the way that I anticipated at all. I think we have this problem in the West sometimes of either like completely ravishing and destroying the natural world and choosing not to see it at all as something with inherent value, which is what we're able to do when we, you know, pack 10,000 hogs into a slaughterhouse like commodities in a supply chain, or put an oil rig deep into the bedrock beneath the Gulf of Mexico. Or on the other hand, put it on this like untouchable pedestal where, you know, for a wilderness area to be considered wilderness, you can't have any humans in it. You know, when we established the national parks, we evacuated them of their indigenous people. And it's sort of like this snow globe. I sort of think about it as like, you know, those people that like whatever buy rare Beanie Babies or like Star Wars collectibles, but then like never play with them. They just like stay in a glass box on a cabinet. Like that's the other end of the spectrum. And I don't know, my sense of the attitude of the very specific tribe of Aboriginal people I was spending time with, the Gularibalu, toward, and I'm not going to say the environment, they'll say their country. And their country is a very specific, but like loosely bordered ecosystem on the northwestern coast of Australia in a region called the Kimberley, called by white people the Kimberley. That relationship was kind of prosaic in a beautiful way, in that like the rocks and the sand and the iguanas and the dolphins that made up that ecosystem, they didn't put them on a pedestal, but they attended to them very closely. The attitude seemed to be like, oh, these things are also part of our society. And in a society, there's give and take, there's animosity, there's debt, there's obligation, there's connection, there's fealty, there's infidelity, there's all these things in society, and that's what the web is made of. And it accommodates all those emotional valences. So it wasn't like this cutesy, precious thing. It was just like, oh yeah, these are our family, you know? And we're embedded in the prosaic way that you are embedded in your family. But like the borders of it extend to include botanical and geological and animal objects. I don't know if I'm making myself clear, but it's sort of like, you know, it just blew through both options that seemed to be on offer in the Western world to just offer something more real and direct and reflective of both the complexity of the natural world and the complexity of humans within it.
Yeah, no, I totally get that. I wonder if you found that to be a useful model for thinking about the future. I found myself, you know, you go through, you reference a lot of philosophers, a lot of thinkers through your book. And one of the things that comes up is various models for thinking about the Anthropocene, for thinking about the future as being very much shaped by human intervention. And obviously that's true on a certain level, but there's part of me that always resists those narratives. Mm. I think because I want there to be an acknowledgement that though we may have irrevocably changed the nature of the world, that doesn't mean that we're determining what's going to happen exactly, because there are all these other forces at play. I mean, at the end of the day, we are still one species, even if we're a very influential species, and we are not outside of nature. So there are a lot of titles that you come across nowadays about, you know, the post-wild world, you know, the end of nature, that kind of thing. Yeah. And I kind of bristle a little bit at that, because I feel like implied in that is still some kind of separation, which feels false to me.
Yeah.
You think I'm just being naive and misunderstanding?
No, I think it's right. I think that reaction is right, because it also implies a kind of hubris, you know?
Yeah.
Like that we have achieved a total domination, which I think we absolutely have not. You know, like at the end of the day, and I talk about this towards the end of the book, the ultimate decisions will be made by the fundamental forces of like rock and water and sun on the planet. You know, like ultimately the oceans and the rate of sedimentation and the heat inherent in the atmosphere will make decisions for us as a civilization that we cannot control. So it's sort of like the way Naomi Klein talks about this is like we tried to control nature, blah, 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 to the utmost degree. And it seemed like it was barely possible. And then nature like reared up off its back and showed itself to be the ultimate arbiter and beyond all control. And we're reaping what we've sown. But, you know, I think that, again, I think there's, to me, a very obvious middle ground that somehow people feel like they need to land on one take or another. Either like we shape everything or we're powerless before this thing called the world. And it seems, and I think that this was how it was talked about in the Aboriginal community, like we're one actor on a stage of an improvisational play. So of course we're going to have influence over the outcome, but we don't have ultimate influence. It's like how our choices interact with, you know, this sort of implacable cascade of biology and physics. And that's a very complicated dance. So if we remove ourselves from that play, we're relinquishing an enormous responsibility. But if we trick ourselves into thinking we're the play's director, we're going to be sorely disappointed and misled, I think, if that's a helpful, metaphor. Yeah.
No, I totally agree. It makes me think there's a landscape architect called Larry Wiener, who in his book, his recent book, he writes about Native American tribes and how for a long time we had this misconception that they had a kind of more pristine, that nature had a more sort of pristine place in pre-Columbian America. But that in fact, I mean, of course, we know now that like they burned prairies and things like that, but that there was much more of a cultivation of the land than we used to think. And there's this one anecdote that he cites where a chief from a Native American tribe goes back and sees Yosemite, I think it is at one point. And he looks around, not sure exactly when this was, and he sort of shrugs and says, you know, people have really been letting things go here. Like who's taking care of things, you know?
Oh, that's great. And, that's great.
There's something just very striking about it. You know, like you said, like there's this tendency to think it's all or nothing, you know, that it's either this pristine wilderness or something that's highly cultivated or controlled. And, you know, you go back in history, really anywhere in the world, and the relationship is much more dynamic and much more complex than that.
Totally. Yeah. And the anecdote that makes me think of, like when I was spending time with the Gulara Baloo, like... On the one time, as like a white boy sort of tagging along in this indigenous walk of this song line, you know, sometimes Gulara Baloo people would do things that I was like, wait, what the fuck? They'd like throw a beer can on the beach, you know, and to me, that was like contravening my environmental piety, like nothing else. Like throw, you know, a beer can on the beach, like this place is pristine, like how are you doing this? But actually structurally in their lives, I think... what we would recognize as their environmentalism, although they would never use the term, and I think it's a red herring to some extent, exists in the fact that they fucking hate the cash economy, you know? Like, they don't, you know, for most of the folks I met, like, they're trying to be out on trail and out in the country and, like, fishing and interacting with land whenever they can, and they work just enough to afford, like, basic accommodations. But basically, they try not to take part in the Western cash economy. Or like the things that it builds. And that is like a much more fundamental quote unquote environmentalism than like throwing a can on the beach or not, you know?
Yeah.
Because like there I was, I would never throw a can on the beach, but I do take flights to attend meetings sometimes or and like just like am fully a part of and willingly a part of a civilization that's like auto-cannibalistic basically. So in some ways, it's like something will never be pristine if you're truly intimate with it. But if you're not intimate with it, it can either be invisible or like falsely preserved. And I think those are the two traps we often fall into.
Let's go back to policy towards the end, just because you're in the thick of it. And I'm curious. So what are the things you're thinking about this fall? Obviously, there's a lot at stake in Congress right now. There's also the UN COP26 coming up. What's kind of on your horizon? What do you feel like the big moments of the day to look out for are?
Yeah, I mean, I really do think it's all about this $3.5 trillion reconciliation package that's making its way through Congress. And it's scary. It's like really on a knife's edge. And it's unclear if it's going to pass or not. And... you know, there's been this game of chicken between the progressives and the quote-unquote moderates, who I would just call the bomb throwers. I don't think they're, in no way are they practicing moderation, about whether we would pass this, the bipartisan infrastructure bill, which is only $1 trillion, and basically rebuilds our nation's bridges and highways, which is long overdue. But if it's not coupled with the second piece of legislation, the cars on those bridges and highways will be fossil fuel cars, and we will further cinch the noose around our necks civilizationally. So passing that one bill by itself is actually, I see, as significantly detrimental. And so the progressives have tried to make sure the two bills are tied together. Nancy Pelosi just last night announced that she would allow a vote on them separately, which is quite scary. And so it's anyone's guess how this can go. And so what I keep telling people right now is, like, find the people politically in your congressional district who are advocating with your member of Congress around the reconciliation bill, and get with them and make calls and get your neighbors to make calls, because this is the most important piece of climate legislation in the history of this country by a wide margin. You know, and I think if we pass that before the COP in Scotland, we're in a really good position, because what the global community says is that the U.S. is able to govern its increasingly unruly democracy, or, you know, its increasingly compromised democracy, I would argue, and that it's putting money where its mouth is in terms of decarbonization. That will be immensely important and will, I think, compel other countries to similarly step up to the bat. The other dynamic I'm watching is what sort of influence the Green Party wields in the new German coalition government. Because I think Germany just has obviously a huge amount of influence over the course of the EU. And Angela Merkel's government was pretty good on some areas of climate, but far too politically squeamish about challenging the coal industry, which is, of course, very powerful in Germany. And so I'm hoping that we get a government of the Social Democrats and the Greens who are much more aggressive about challenging the fossil fuel industry in Europe, which will send further market signals around the world. And then meanwhile, you know, there's a lot to be done at the state and local level. And part of my job is organizing with labor unions. Right now, I'm running a campaign in 12 states around the country, led by teachers unions and building trades unions, to try to get commitments around decarbonizing the entire public school sector, which would abate a lot of greenhouse gases and create thousands and thousands of union jobs and save schools, school districts money. So both all the levels, local, state, federal, global, all of them are necessary, but none are in and of themselves sufficient. Like, we have to win on every level. And so I think people need to decide proactively, and there's no right decision. The only bad decision is not to make one, but they have to decide where their political home is going to be and where they think, given the sorts of communities and networks that they're embedded in, where they can leverage the most power. And maybe that is your local city council, and that's great. And then dig in there and try to win the biggest victory they can on that level. And it all adds up, and it's all important.
Once again, I want to remind you to go to sunrisemovement.org and do what you can to get Congress to pass meaningful climate legislation. Coming up, I'll have an interview with artists Ed Morris and Susanna Saylor, founders of the Canary Project, about the role of art in the climate crisis. And I'll also be talking to science writer David Biello about his book, The Unnatural World. See you soon.